60 feet, that is all. 60 feet above black water in the dead of night. Four Merlin engines screaming, flak tracers reaching up like fingers trying to pull you down. And you have to hold it steady. You have to hold it rock steady because the bomb in your belly is not a bomb at all. It is a spinning cylinder. And if you drop it 1 second too early or 1 second too late, it skips the wrong direction and the whole mission, the whole beautiful insane idea, dies right there on the surface of a German reservoir. I'm Tail Dragger, and this is the Hangar on Radio Hangar. Pull up a chair, because tonight we are going back 83 years to the minute to one of the most audacious air raids ever flown. Today's show is brought to you by AviationSoul.com. Aviation Challenge coins for every milestone in flight. First solo, private pilot, instrument rating, all the way up. If you've earned it, they've got a coin for it. Every coin tells a story. Check them out at AviationSoul.com. The story starts not with a pilot, but with an engineer, Barnes Wallace. Brilliant man. Quiet. The kind of fellow who would sit in a room full of generals and calmly explain that he intended to destroy the industrial heart of Nazi Germany by bouncing a bomb across a lake like a child skipping stones. You can imagine the silence in that room. Wallace had studied the Ruhr Valley dams for years, the Moni, the Eder, the Sorp. These were not just concrete walls holding back water. They were the lifeblood of German steel production, German power generation, German everything. The Moni Dam alone held 134 million cubic meters of water. Breach those dams, Wallace argued, and you flood the factories, you drown the coal mines, you wash away the rail lines. You hit Germany where no amount of fighter cover can protect it. The problem was hitting them at all. Conventional bombing from altitude could not crack those massive gravity dams. The walls were over 100 feet thick at the base. You could drop a tall boy on them and barely scratch the surface. Wallace knew you had to get the explosive right up against the face of the dam, underwater, where the hydraulic pressure would do the real work. But how do you deliver a bomb to the precise face of a curved dam wall, protected by torpedo nets? You skip it. Wallace designed a cylindrical bomb, about 5 feet long, roughly the size of an oil drum weighing just over 9,000 pounds. Before release, the weapon was spun backward at 500 revolutions per minute by a belt-driven motor inside the Lancaster's bomb bay. When it hit the water at the right speed and the right height, the backspin made it bounce. Skip after skip after skip, right over the torpedo nets until it struck the dam wall. Then the backspin pressed it against the face of the dam as it sank. A hydrostatic fuse triggered the charge at 30 feet below the surface, and the physics did the rest. Beautiful on paper, terrifying in practice. Now here is where it gets interesting. To make the bomb work, the crews had to fly at exactly 60 feet above the water and at exactly 232 miles per hour. Not approximately, exactly, at night, under fire, over water that gave you no depth perception whatsoever? How do you hold 60 feet over a black lake in 1943? You do not have a radar altimeter, you do not have a heads-up display. What you have is two spotlights mounted under the aircraft, one in the nose and one in the tail, angled so that their beams converge on the surface of the water at precisely 60 feet. When the two spots of light merged into a figure eight on the lake surface, your navigator called it and you held that altitude. If the spots were apart, you were too high. If they overlapped completely, you were too low and you were about to become part of the lake. The speed problem they solved with simple math and a marked airspeed indicator. But the range to target, the exact moment of release, that took something even more clever. The bomb aimer used a handheld wooden triangle, basically a Y-shaped sight with a peephole and two nails. When the two towers of the dam lined up with the two nails, you were at the correct distance. 425 yards. Release all of this invented, tested, and trained in a matter of weeks. The man chosen to lead this mission was Wing Commander Guy Gibson, 24 years old. 24, he had already flown over 170 operations, bombers and night fighters both, the kind of pilot who should have been dead three times over by the statistics of Bomber Command. Gibson was not warm. He was not beloved in the way some commanders are. He was exacting, demanding, relentless. But the men who flew with him trusted him completely, because he never asked anyone to do something he would not do first and do harder. Gibson handpicked his crews for the newly formed 617 Squadron. They trained at low level over the lakes and reservoirs of England, flying at night, flying at treetop height, driving farmers and villagers absolutely mad with the thunder of four Merlins at chimney level. They practiced over the Derwent Reservoir, over the Ibrook Reservoir, again and again perfecting the spotlight technique. Perfecting the bomb run, they had no idea what the target was. Only Gibson and a handful of officers knew. The rest of the crews were told nothing until the afternoon of May, the 16th, 1943. That evening, 19 modified Lancaster bombers took off from RAF Scampton in three waves. The first wave, 9 aircraft led by Gibson himself, would hit the Moni Dam. Whatever aircraft had bombs remaining would continue to the Eater. The second wave of 5 aircraft would attack the SORP. The third wave of 5 was a mobile reserve to be directed to targets as needed. They flew across the North Sea at treetop level, so low that at least one aircraft clipped the surface of the water and had to turn back. They crossed the Dutch coast and the flak opened up immediately. The losses started before they even reached Germany.
Flight Lieutenant Bill Astell's Lancaster was hit by flak and crashed into a field, all 7 crew killed. Pilot Officer Vernon Byers was shot down over the coast. Pilot Officer Jeff Rice flew so low his bomb was ripped from the aircraft by the water itself. He survived but had to turn back. The second wave heading for the SORP was savaged of 5 aircraft. Only 2 reached the target. Gibson reached the Moni Dam with his first wave, and here is where Guy Gibson earned every decoration they ever gave him. He made the first run himself, his Lancaster callsign G for George, roared across the lake at 60 feet, spotlights burning, flak pouring off the dam towers. His bomb aimer, Spam Spafford, released the weapon. It bounced. It struck the dam. It detonated. An enormous column of water erupted into the night sky, 1,000 feet high. When the spray cleared, the dam was still standing. Gibson did not hesitate. He called in the next aircraft, Flight Lieutenant Hoppy, Hopgood and M for Mother, and here's what Gibson did. He flew his own Lancaster alongside Hopgood's, directly into the flak, with his identification lights on, drawing fire away from Hopgood's aircraft. He made himself a target to protect his wingmen. It was not enough. Hopgood was hit on the run, his aircraft caught fire, his bomb released late, bounced over the dam and detonated on the power station below. Hopgood's Lancaster crashed on the far side. 2 of his crew survived by parachute. 5 died. Gibson called in the third aircraft, Flight Lieutenant Mick Martin, and again, Gibson flew alongside, drawing fire. Martin's bomb skipped but missed the dam face. 4th aircraft. Squadron leader Dingy Young, Gibson flew escort again. Young's bomb hit the dam squarely. A crack appeared in the wall. 5th aircraft. Flight Lieutenant Dave Maltby, Gibson once more flew into the flak beside him. Maltby released. The bomb bounced true, struck the wall, sank and detonated, and the Moni Dam broke. The wall crumbled. A gap opened, and 134 million cubic meters of water thundered through, a wall of destruction roaring down the Moni Valley into the Ruhr. It swept away bridges, roads, factories, power stations, everything in its path. The flood wave would travel over 50 miles. Gibson had 3 aircraft with bombs remaining. He led them east to the Eater Dam, which was undefended but infinitely more dangerous to attack. The Eater sat in a steep valley. To make a run, a Lancaster had to dive over a castle on a hilltop, descend rapidly to 60 feet over the lake, line up on the dam, and release, all while pulling out before hitting the hillside on the other side. There was no room for error. There was barely room for the airplane. Flight Lieutenant Dave Shannon made 2 runs and had to pull away both times, unable to get set. On the third run, his bomb bounced too far left. Flight Lieutenant Les Knight made a perfect run. His bomb struck the dam and detonated. The Eater cracked but held. Squadron leader Henry Maudsley made his run. Something went wrong. His bomb may have been released late. It detonated as his aircraft was still over the dam. Maudsley's Lancaster staggered away, burning, and crashed shortly after. All 7 crew were killed. Shannon came back for another run. This time everything aligned. His bomb hit true. The Eater Dam burst. A second flood wave poured into the German countryside. The SORP Dam was attacked by just 2 aircraft. Its design, an earthen dam with a concrete core, made it far more resistant to the bouncing bomb. Both weapons detonated against it but failed to breach it. The SORP held of the 19 Lancasters that took off from Scampton that night. 8 did not come home. 53 airmen were killed. 3 were captured. The youngest was 20 years old. Gibson circled the breached Moan Dam one last time, watching the floodwaters pour through before turning for home. He landed at Scampton as dawn was breaking. When they told him the Eater was breached too, he allowed himself a small smile for his leadership on the raid. Guy Gibson was awarded the Victoria Cross, the highest military honor in the British Commonwealth. He was 24 years old. He would be dead within 18 months, killed on a routine mosquito operation over the Netherlands in September of 1944. He was 26. The Dambusters raid remains one of the most remarkable precision bombing operations in history, not because of the technology, though that spinning cylinder was a work of mad genius. Not because of the results, which were devastating but ultimately repaired by the Germans within months. It endures because of what it asked men to do. Fly at 60 feet at night, into gunfire. Hold the aircraft steady on 2 spots of light while a wooden triangle tells you when to drop. and when your wingman gets hit, watch the next man go in, and then go in again yourself. That is flying. That is what human beings are capable of when someone draws a line on a map and says, we need to get there, and there is no way to get there, and they go anyway. The research for tonight's segment drew from Guy Gibson's own memoir, Enemy Coast Ahead, from James Holland's comprehensive history, Dam Busters, and from the official Royal Air Force 617 Squadron records. You can find more episodes at radiohangar.com. Fly safe out there, and remember what 60 feet looks like the next time you think your traffic pattern altitude is low. I'm Taildragger. See you next time.